Hi.
I'm John D'Amico.
Shit.
Welcome to Screaming at the Light, a podcast affectionately and seriously devoted to horror films, why we like them, what makes them work. I'm John D'Amico, and with me is...
Brad Avery.
Last week, we were talking about Final Destination and the sort of like weird climactic place it takes in the slasher genre. And we mentioned casually one point about it that we thought was kind of worth bringing up again. So Final Destination was originally written and conceptualized as a spec script for the X-Files. Instead, it became a movie. As a movie versus an X-Files episode, Brad, what is missing?
There is no Mulder and Scully. There instead are two FBI guys who do nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Show up, they're gone, they're useless, they're out of there. Yeah. But TV horror always seems to have a Mulder and Scully. The X-Files, The Outer Limits, Boris Karloff's Thriller, all the way back that far, and you always have a narrator and a sort of crypt keeper.
A Rod Serling.
Serling, exactly. Hitchcock in Hitchcock Presents. As that type of a guide kind of fell by the wayside, it sort of became integrated into the show itself with Kolchak the Night Stalker, which is about a reporter who checks in on all of these stories, and he's not a part of them. He's just passing through these supernatural events. And then Are You Afraid of the Dark, of course, the Midnight Society, where they tell you each story. There's always a bit of a fanfare around that, you know.
Scooby-Doo.
Buffy has Giles, and even Buffy herself sort of is just a passerby in these events. And the X-Files, of course, has Mulder and Scully, who are the biggest example of this this peculiarity to television horror, this need for a sort of outsider, kind of square character to kind of help you through it. Film doesn't really have this. We don't have this sort of need for a kind of gatekeeper. You just sort of dive in. And I think this is interesting because it shows the roots of the genre in a kind of peculiar way. So horror is the oldest genre. It's as old as the Old Testament. It's as old as Gilgamesh. It's as old as Aesop and the morality stories that we don't even know that they were telling kids 20,000 years ago to get them to eat their caveman vegetables. It's a very old conceptual thing. The supernatural forces that are going to jack you up. But it's new relatively to cinema, particularly American cinema. It was not until 1931, not until Carl Laemmle Jr. took a chance on Dracula, that American cinema had a film with a supernatural force in it that was purely supernatural. It wasn't until 1944 with The Uninvited that a non-comedy had a ghost in it as a character taken seriously as a ghost. The Uninvited in 44. This is the middle of World War II. This is decades after the invention of cinema. It wasn't until then that you had a ghost where it was not a question of whether there was a ghost. Most of the great early horror movies, for example, the Val Lewton movies, The Woman Who Came Back, I Bury the Living, Secrets of the Blue Room, all of them have this sort of detective-y element. All of them have the question of whether there's a supernatural. And almost invariably, the answer was no in the beginning of the genre. Invariably, you had movies like Secrets of the Blue Room where they set you up with a mystery, a murder mystery that seems like it can only be solved by supernatural means.
You joke about it, but strange things do happen. Even in these days.
And it turns out to be natural.
Why did you do it?
I knew that Walter and Frank stood between me and Irene.
You have to get a couple of decades into sound cinema before American film becomes comfortable with the notion of that answer to that question was the supernatural. You have to get that far before the answer is yes. And you have to get even farther before there's not a question in the first place. Before something supernatural happens and it's simply something supernatural that is happening. The reason for this, I think, is that horror cinema in America is the child of detective fiction. It's the child of the Penny Dreadfuls, which were violent events that always had a detective character going through them and figuring out how they weren't the fairy tale monster that they were supposed to be. The best example of this is John Dixon Carr. Did you ever read him?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, he was a really exceptional mystery author. He excelled in what was called the locked room mystery that they don't do so much anymore. And his best version of it was this book in 1935 called The Three Coffins.
Some extracts from notes made by me, Gideon Fell, on the night of Saturday, February the 9th, 1935.
Are you telling me this mysterious stranger just disappeared off the face of the earth?
Where in the middle of the book, when it becomes time for him to tell the solution, the detective, Dr. Gideon Fell, who was kind of his go-to guy, says, listen, we're in a detective book right now, and it's not worth pretending we're not. Let me just lay out the possible solutions to this kind of mystery. Number one, it's not murder, but a series of coincidences ending in an accident, which looks like murder. Number two, it is murder, but the victim is impelled to kill himself or crash into an accidental death. Three, it is murder by a mechanical device already planted in the room. Four, it is suicide intended to look like murder. Five, it is a murder which derives its problem from illusion and impersonation. Six, it is murder which, although committed by somebody outside the room, nevertheless seems to have been committed by somebody who must have been inside. So these were kind of the groundworks for ghost mystery type literature and film in the 30s.
It's a little like Scream in that sense.
Yes, very much like Scream. And you can see that sort of root in Final Destination even. Number two, it is murder, but the victim is impelled to kill himself or crash into an accidental death. Is kind of the Final Destination movies. But what horror cinema started to do around the 1940s, what if we do a locked room mystery and the solution is that it was what we thought it was at first, something supernatural? And Val Lewton was kind of the first one to dip his toes into it.
People bowed down to Satan and said their masses to him. They had become witches and were evil.
Hitchcock dipped his toes into it in Rebecca and then sort of backed away.
Do you think the dead come back and watch the living?
We try to figure out what was killing Mina Harker, and it turns out it's Dracula.
I was telling her some rather grim tales of my far-off country.
It was the first time any major American film ever posited that solution. And Dracula was a huge, huge, huge hit.
Right.
But it's a slow pace out of the detective story route. It's a slow route going from, okay, first you take away the solution and you get stuff like, say, Night of the Demon.
I have an imagination like anyone else. It's easy to see a demon in every dark corner.
Then what killed my uncle?
In 1958, where, yeah, it's a curse and it's a fucking devil. Congratulations.
And then he just has to figure out how to beat the curse, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you kind of move a little further into the 60s, into the 70s, and you take away the detective. And then you get these sort of supernatural horror movies that are, you know, The Exorcist, where it's just people trying to deal with this event.
Somewhere between science and superstition, there is another world, the one hope, the only hope. The Exorcist.
Eventually, you get down the line to stuff like, say, Final Destination or It Follows or Paranormal Activity or whatever, where it's taken for granted that this is a supernatural thing that you can't solve, and eventually it's just going to win, and it's only a matter of time. And it's this exploration of the murder that was at the heart of the murder mystery. You essentially jettison everything and reduce the murder mystery to what was always at its kind of spiritual center, which was this just crystallized sort of murder, this death. It's what we were talking about, Final Destination. You just start to explore this concept of like, okay, what is death? How does it work? What are its forms? How does it feel? All of that kind of stuff. You know, you start to get to stuff like Evil Dead 1 when he flicks the projector on and it's just blood dripping down the screen.
Right.
It's really just about violence and death. And people use that as a knock. Personally, I think it's the power of the genre, but either way. And it also follows the line of the loosening of censorship. You can explore death more when you have more ability to explore death, when you get past 68 and you no longer have Hays Code restrictions on your movies, when you start to figure out special effects in the 70s and the 80s, and you have really like realistic looking corpses and blood that doesn't look like paint. And then when you get CGI and you can do things like the log truck scene in Final Destination, or you can do, you know, really sort of nightmarish, outlandish things. Well, that was the... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, sort of, this evolution also comes with that being able to do more and sort of figuring out the film technique. I mean, it does, though, have its origins back in the silent era of, you know, the surrealist filmmakers, of the early experimental filmmakers, of the people who would tinker around, and they try to find out, what can I do to create an effect on camera through film? And you go to the very beginning.
The first special effect was the execution of, I think it was Marie Antoinette. It's like a 1 minute little short, and it's just a cut from the actress to a dummy, and the dummy getting its head cut off. Its first special effect was a murder.
Right, and, you know, you look at, like, Georges Méliès over in France, and, you know, again, he did some stuff with ghosts and magic, because he was a magician, and loved playing around with, you know, sort of, you know, floating heads and disappearing heads, and you know, people who had become dead all of a sudden, like, and I say become dead, not die, in different ways of the way he would present these illusions through film.
Yeah, or become demons, or become...
Right.
Disembodied, or talking heads on plates, or...
Exactly.
Sergei Chaumont would do these great images of, like, monsters and people trapped in bottles, little homunculi, and all these sort of...
Right.
Playing with what you could do by cutting slices of your frame out.
Those surrealist elements, those surreal moments are where horror cinema smuggles the surreal into the mainstream. And even talking about, you know, those homunculi in bottles is what makes its way into The Bride of Frankenstein, based on what can be done on camera.
Yeah, you sort of money launder surrealism. You know, basically every shot of Un Chien Andalou ended up in a horror movie at one point or another afterwards, in the years afterwards.
It's sort of always been what's been going on. Like, you look at, you know, something like the black backdrops of, like, a Kenneth Anger film, and the only place you could see that in a mainstream film where the audience would go along with it is in a horror movie, where sometimes the horror movies just throw a character onto a black backdrop. You know... Even look at a modern example of something like Get Out with the sunken place. It's the type. It's that horror gives us the invitation to accept the surreal, to accept the irrational. Talking about the mundane invaded by the irrational, when we, the audience, watch a horror movie, we are opening ourselves up to go along with an experimental form, go along with something that is not real, in order to take the experience. Whereas if we were presented with Un Chien Andalou, we would recoil, because it has no form at all.
You would recoil, or you would put it in a modern art museum.
Right.
If you were presented with the monster movies that took its imagery in the 40s, 30s, and 50s, you would either laugh at it or throw it away, which is the double standard between the high art and the low art again. But yeah, it's sort of the money laundering place for experimental cinema. I mean, even something like Sinister, that sort of okay Ethan Hawke horror movie about the evil videotapes. You know, those things look like Jonas Mekas movies.
Right.
You know, the jittery frames and the sped up stuff. And, you know, the tape and the ring. You die seven days later because you were watching experimental cinema.
It becomes part of the plot. Becomes part of the story. You get engaged with it. And you can accept the surrealist little short film in the middle of the ring, because it's framed in a way that makes it acceptable.
Exactly. And here's where it gets interesting. Because like I was saying, this route from an American cinema of horror being unshackled from the detective story, this is because America never really had a surrealist cinema, not in any meaningful way to the extent of, say, like a France or particularly a Germany or a Russia before the revolution. So the nations with surrealist cinemas start to get full-blown supernatural horror movies quite a bit earlier than we do. I mean, basically instantly they get them. And they're pretty spectacular. Stuff like The Phantom Carriage, Nosferatu, Caligari, all of them. You know, these masterpieces of horror that we know from the silent era and the years after are... expressionism. You know, there's words for them that come from the world of fine art. Caligari is literally abstract expressionist paintings with people walking over them. We didn't do anything like that in America. We never had that sort of relationship with art. We have a different relationship with art that has its pluses and minuses, and it's our relationship with art that allows us to have Halloween, but it's also our relationship with cinema that kept us from having a Phantom Carriage.
Right. And then the Phantom Carriage makes its way into The Shining.
Right, yeah. Once again, it's then money laundered twice.
Right.
You know, it's imagery from the world of post-World War I fine art pushed into spooky cinema and then taken through the high road out of European art cinema into American blockbuster cinema, which we pretend now The Shining was like a crazy art film when it came out.
Yeah.
That was like blockbuster horror cinema. That was...
Right.
We're remiss if we pretend that wasn't the equivalent of, like, Annabelle.
Yeah. And, you know, going back, though, is that detective tradition has remained. And, you know, bringing up Annabelle is, you know, the Conjuring movies have turned, what is it, Ed and Lorraine Warren into the Nick and Nora of the supernatural.
Which is interesting because the Conjuring movies are basically, I mean, they're almost like a TV show.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And you create a film series based around these connecting characters who investigate.
They're presented to you.
Yeah.
In a way that a lot of movies aren't presented to you, which is interesting because The Conjuring movies, horror people tend to really not like them.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, non-horror people seem to really click with them.
Yeah,
and exactly. I wonder about that minor element being a part of it. What's interesting about it, I think, is you go back to the timeline of when American cinema starts to lose the detective element and becomes just films of violence. And it's coordinated pretty well inherently with the decline in censorship in American cinema. And the decline in censorship on American television, as you know, was like way later.
Yeah.
And
that was dealing more with that it was in people's homes, that it was more directly accessible by children. It was more mainstream. That was more controlled. It was, you know, more like radio.
Yeah.
Rather than Movie Palace, which is more like an art show.
Yeah, you had to still have this caveat of this protective characters, you know. You weren't allowed to have a universe where you were out of control in the same way you are in horror films, where you can have films where you don't have a protective character in that sense. But what's interesting is now that we've hit the point where television has the same lack of limitations and censorship that... film does, and look what's the big horror show now. It's American Horror Story.
Right.
Which is full-on, like, weird-ass, surrealist. It's an anthology that doesn't have a narrator. You know, you're kind of left out there in the lurch every season. It has no protections left.
I mean, the new Twin Peaks goes full horror. It goes full, completely surreal.
Does it really? I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's really good. I mean, I don't want to spoil it for you, but I'm sure a lot of people listening will watch it.
I don't care.
Part 8, episode 8, is just this disturbing, you know, little interlude of pure experimental cinema. For about 20 minutes, it turns into like a Paul Sheritz movie of flashing lights sound and noise before it spits you out in just one of the darkest, creepiest horror movies of these weird stalking ash woodmen who go around and murder people in a small town. And it's a extremely dark surrealist vision of a classic 50s, drive-in movie. And this is showing up on premium cable as a prestige television series that, millions of people are watching.
How does it differ from the original Twin Peaks, which I don't really remember that well because I don't think I ever finished it, to be honest.
Well, wildly. Like, the original Twin Peaks is more grounded in sort of the soap opera scenario. It's more grounded in this small town series of, the dynasties and the those primetime soap operas of the era mixed with the murder mystery series, just that classic, there's the mystery of, who killed Laura Palmer, and that's the glue of the series. It's more comedic. You have Agent Cooper as your grounding figure, and the new series completely eschews that. It takes Agent Cooper and it turns him, it splits him off into multiple personalities of, you have an evil doppelganger of him going out and committing murders and rapes, and then you have him escaping from a alternate reality back into reality where he has lost his mind and is just a childlike cipher. It deliberately removes your figure, like you said, the detective or your host,
your guide. Yeah,
your guide is gone. Your guide is now a child and is repeating words and work. It's basically Lynch's Jacques Tati movie. That those sequences are hilarious, but again, it's sort of the surrealism invading television, and I'm curious to see what happens as a result of Twin Peaks, as far as its influence on the future of television goes. Because, like you said, American Horror Story sort of goes wild with it, and Twin Peaks goes wild in a completely different way.
I mean, the shame about American Horror Story is that it sucks.
Right.
If we have a good American Horror Story now, that should swing some doors open.
Yeah, something that completely breaks all grounding of conventional mainstream storytelling.
But I think it's important that people know about this path. I think it's important to look at horror movies, which, as we've talked about and we'll talk again, are so formalized and so ritualistic and so solidly grounded in plot mechanics, to realize that this genre isn't something that was always there in film. It was something that we sort of had to be okay with deciding that, okay, we're going to make movies that are just about this. And right. That's the element of it, I think, that people are still uncomfortable with, this idea that we're going to make movies that are just about people getting dead.
Yeah.
And people getting hurt and people being scared.
I mean, that has its apex in Faces of Death.
Yeah, the Mondo cinema, which is this just super gross, like, blending of real and fake death scenes. This lingering question always of the why. But when you start to add some of the formalized elements back in, when you start to do a show that's about death, if we're talking about television, the way Homicide was, or The Wire was, or 6 Feet Under was, but you push it back into rationality a little bit, it becomes more of a comfort for people. It becomes this sort of like, okay, we can have this conversation about death. In film, I'd say The Sweet Hereafter is a good example.
Well, I think it's also, it's because, like, the procedural or the investigation series is about the repercussions of death. Horror cinema is about the death itself.
Well, not always, because the best scene in Halloween 2, which is, I know you're on board with that one too.
Oh, Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
Zombie's Halloween 2 is when Brad Dourif comes home and finds out that his daughter has been murdered by Michael Myers.
Oh, right.
Which is the scene that's implicitly removed from every single slasher film before it.
I mean, that movie is so good for that too, because that has the scene where, like, Malcolm McDowell's at his book signing And you get all the horror serial killer fanboys who are coming up to him being like, Michael Myers the coolest. And then you get the dad of one of the victims who just chews him out for capitalizing on his daughter's death. And it's just one of those real moments that brings it back home.
Yeah, it's that discomfort. Yeah. The discomfort that people have with, which I get, but the distance between the sweet hereafter and that scene from Halloween 2 is that it's still grounded in a rational universe. And I think there's more value in the discussions of death where it's not grounded in a rational universe.
Yeah.
Because, you know, death is the force we lose to.
Right.
It is Michael Myers. It's always there.
And, you know, it's sort of the question that's only sometimes brought up in horror movies is, you know, how do we cope with death? You know,
right.
And it seems that that's only sometimes brought up because so often you're in the moment of it and you're still in the fight or flight mode. It's still about survival as well.
Right. Which is why Halloween 2 is such a great movie.
Yeah.
Because it begins with 45 minutes of people trying to move on from the events of Halloween 1.
Right.
Which is really a fascinating thing. But also, I mean, The Shining does such a great job at that that coping stuff. I mean, the scene where he's screaming on the floor because he wakes up from the nightmare about killing his family is like, you could cut that scene and move it to the end of the movie, and that could be the beginning of The Shining 2. And that sort of moving the sweet hereafter aftermath scene to the middle of the movie is, when you think about it, kind of a common trick in horror movies. So many of them start with a loss that's unrelated to the loss in the rest of it. You know,
right.
The Exorcist with the single parent stuff that she's going through.
Don't Look Now.
Don't Look Now. Certainly, yeah, great example. Almost every ghost movie in its way. An interesting example of this that comes right up to the door of being a horror movie and stays a mystery movie is Rebecca.
What are the horror elements in Rebecca? What makes it border that line so closely, and what stops it from being a true horror movie?
Well, it's that 5-degree move from a domestic drama to a horror. You know, it's that 5 degrees from whether the first wife is haunting her or not, or only metaphorically haunting her. I mean, it's about whether the metaphor is literalized, really, whether the subconscious breaks through. This is this phrase that we keep repeating, the mundane being invaded by the irrational, is about whether your subconscious worries and your subconscious fears literalize or stay metaphorical. If they literalize, you're dealing with a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
If they stay subconscious, if they stay metaphorical, you have a creepy drama.
And that is why, as well, that you can bring the surrealist cinema and surrealist art into the horror movie is because it's about manifesting the nightmares. And I think what makes surrealist cinema so difficult for mainstream audiences to digest is that there's no through line. There's, you know, there's certainly no guide, like on a television show, but there's also, you know, there's no guide of the plot. The plot, in many ways, serves as a guide for a mainstream audience by introducing us to characters. When surrealist cinema is devoid of that, you feel lost, you feel thrown into it. And so mainstream audiences, you know, look at it like, you know, maybe if they were in an art museum, they would watch this. But by taking those elements and putting them into the framework, it becomes acceptable. Like you said, it's money laundered. It's suddenly palatable. And you can understand it.
I wonder if that's part of why horror movie fans are so dismissive of Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. I mean, they hate it so much in general. Because it's sort of... horror movies get to be non-literal and surreal and crazy, in part because they have this rigid formula that they tend not to stray from. They have this, as we've called it, this ritual, these steps that you walk on before you confront these personal horrors. And Halloween 2 kind of mixes those steps up. It kind of, you know, it gives you too much of the sadness and not enough of the
thrill.
Yeah, the thrill. There's this great line in The Office, the sitcom, where the receptionist Erin keeps losing bets with her boyfriend, who's like a big horror movie guy. And she's this like really sweet, innocent girl. So she says,
"So far, I've seen The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, The Ring. Not really my thing. Although, I do like the early parts of the movies where they have a perfect family and everything."
And I think that really points to this like crystal that all these horror movies begin with before they break it. If they're about something being fundamentally broken about your place in the world.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
They have to, at the beginning, establish this like intact little Fabergé egg of a neat world. A good example of this actually is Scott Tobias's review for It, the new Stephen King movie.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote this review for NPR, praises the film and the novel by totally mischaracterizing what horror movies are about. He says, in the best Stephen King adaptations, and the best Stephen King novels for that matter, there's precious little daylight between the psychic stresses of the characters and the supernatural forces that torment them. Carrie, The Shining, The Dead Zone, Christine. All are defined by the frightening intimacy of terrors that come from within, rather than external forces that can be vanquished like a priest exorcising a demon or ghosts expelled from a haunted house. And what he's not understanding there is that every horror movie is about a fear from within. Every horror movie is about the internal coming out.
It's that he's half right there.
He's right up on the track. Yeah.
He doesn't. Yeah. It's that what he has identified is true to the entire genre, from the lowest gutter trash up to, you know, the most prestige art horror.
His example is the priest exorcising the demon in The Exorcist. I mean, The Exorcist is about Reagan getting over the trauma of having a working single mother who doesn't seem to pay her a lot of attention, the trauma of puberty, and probably the trauma of being raped by that guy Denning who falls out the window in the middle of the movie.
Right.
Because there's a lot of stuff going on in there that points to the demon really being things she learned from Denning.
Yeah.
And that violation. And even if it's not spelled out to the degree it's spelled out in It, it's the central tenet of the movie, because it's a central tenet of a haunting. Ghosts expelled from a haunted house. I mean, Paranormal Activity, which gets more shit than anything, despite being, I think, a stone-cold masterpiece. I mean, Paranormal Activity is about broken gender dynamics in a marriage that isn't working. And it also manages to be a really strong movie about people who have too much house, you know? They literally, like, it's 2 years before the housing collapse when that movie was made, or maybe a year before it. It was released a year after it. But it, like, perfectly captures this zeitgeist of, like, just, like, these vast empty plains of a house and, like, this childless family that, like, are trapped literally by their house. Predator, you know, it's about, it's probably about being gay.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But I they're all about psychic stresses from within.
Yeah, like, you can apply it to, you know, what about a movie like The Descent? Absolutely, same thing.
That's right.
It's all about, you know, this in that one, so making it literal, you descend into the internal cavern of your mind, where you're forced to confront all your traumas and your fears and regrets in the form of these, you know, cave goblins or whatever they are. But it makes the metaphor literal.
That's right. And that really, I think, is the cleave between horror and the detective story. The detective story is about being forced to look at the terrible thing somebody else did. And right. A horror movie, what it works, is about being forced to deal with the horrible things you do or were done to you.
Right.
And that's where it starts to get back to surrealism again. You look at something like the very underrated Messiah of Evil. You seen that one?
Yep.
Messiah of Evil, man, like...
Love it. Best movie.
It's so good, right?
Best movie.
Didn't you see that in theaters? Is that when you saw
it? I saw that at the Harvard Film Archive.
At Harvard.
On, like, a red as hell scratched up grindhouse print. Like, it was great.
I saw it at Harvard.
Oh, it was great because they were, like, doing this series of sort of, like, midnight movie type things. And they were trying to present it in an academic sense. But it's just, that movie goes on. And, again, it's about the irrational breakdown. And for all the guy doing the intro tried to present it in an academic light, that movie defies that type of analysis, or at least that type of air of posterity or of formality.
It's visceral, you mean?
It's visceral. It's nightmarish. It gets right to your fucking soul.
There's a Christopher Morley essay about Shakespeare from the 30s where he says the problem with Shakespeare is that the way we teach him as the producer of the greatest masterpieces in the language, we essentially embalm him. And we can't really engage honestly with Shakespeare anymore because we've put him on a pedestal. And that's sort of the thing that academia does to horror. A horror movie will make you jump, even if it's not a good movie. If it times something well enough, a trash movie will make you go, wah, and jump. Right. And there's a sort of resentment about that. And I think academic approaches to horror tend to wait until the things they do to scare you are so commonplace that they don't scare you anymore. They wait until that moment to say that they were powerful and scary films.
Yeah. It's how many people describe a cat scare as cheap, as if it's cheating because it got you.
Yeah, but it's supposed to get you.
Yeah.
Horror movies are supposed to get you.
Right.
You go, you get amped up, and you get scared, and then you leave covered in popcorn because you threw it all over yourself.
Right. I mean, seeing the new It movie in a AMC for like a sold-out 10 o'clock screening where it's just teenagers was probably the best experience you can have because you're listening to an audience that gets scared and then laughs because they got scared because they realized that the film actually got to them for a moment. It actually spooked them.
Yeah.
And then you get that collective sense of like, oh my God, I can't believe that just did it to me. And that's sort of where even in a movie like It, where, you know, this again, all this, you know, metaphor about abuse and, you know, not even metaphor, but literal, you know, subject of abuse, it still sort of has that joy of the collective audience experience of, like, it's a horror movie, it scared me.
Yeah. And then you get the people, they're always adults and they're always kind of nerdy, who will insist that horror movies don't scare them, they only startle them. Like, shut the fuck up. Shut up. But that's the DMZ, absolutely, right? That's the 5 degrees from drama to horror. That's the distance, the letting the subconscious break through within the confines of the film and letting the movie break through to your kind of animal instincts to work on you in a way that you can't consciously control.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's as good a way to end it for now.